You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And it is Friday, so it's time for Brunch with Bernie, our national town hall meeting with a guy I think of as America's senator. And I know a lot of Americans do, although Vermonters are very proud to call him their own, Senator Bernie Sanders. Bernie, welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Thank you. Last Friday, I was the lead speaker at the Occupy the Supreme Court permitted rally that we had down there in front of the Supreme Court for a couple of hours. So, you know, this was all about Citizens United. I know you've got an amendment to the Constitution going on that. I'm curious how that is. The State of the Union happened this last week, and the Postal Service is in the news. So I'm just curious.
Well, there's a lot that's happening. Let's start off with the Citizens United situation. And congratulations to you and all the people who showed up at the Supreme Court and at demonstrations all over the country. I think, Tom, people are increasingly focusing on Citizens United when they see what's happening in the primary states that the Republicans are contesting right now. You are seeing in Florida, literally today in South Carolina, a week ago, huge amounts of money coming in from super PACs, flooding the airwaves without any disclosure. And that means that there's just an incredible bombardment of money from people who just have special needs, special interests out there. I'll give you an example. There was a piece in Forbes just today online, and it says Sheldon Adelson and his wife have each committed $5 million to Gingrich. The article headlines, Sheldon Adelson could give $1 billion to Gingrich and not notice. The only constraint is the embarrassment to Gingrich himself. So you are moving to a situation where, in a sense, politicians are going to be owned lock, stock, and barrel by individuals or corporations who, if we do not overturn Citizens United, if we don't pass legislation to diminish the power of them, will be able to flood the airwaves in support of their candidate and in opposition to other candidates. This is a unprecedented attack on democracy in America. It gives the wealthy and corporations power that they have never had before. And I should tell you, by the way, that the Republicans want to go even further. It is not good enough that corporations can now flood the airwaves without disclosure. They are moving now toward wanting corporations to be able to directly fund candidates. And I suspect in the future they'll be wanting to do away with all restrictions in terms of limitations on funding.
We should pass a law saying that the candidates have to wear NASCAR patches.
Well, the truth is that is what we are moving to. You know, it reminds me of free agency in baseball. You know, these guys, their contract expires. They go out and they get the highest bid they can, and they work for that team.
Right.
And that is what you're looking at. Yeah. Will it be General Motors or Bank of America who will pay me more in terms of campaign contributions and support of my campaign? And, you know, that is not what the democracy that most Americans believe in, what people fought and died to defend. So long term, we have got to pass a constitutional amendment, number of amendments out there. I have one which probably goes a little bit further than others, basically says corporations are not people. Of course, the Congress and legislatures have the right to regulate campaign financing. Corporations cannot contribute to individuals. I should mention, Tom, we have now, I believe, 195,000, in a sense, citizen co-sponsors for that amendment. People can sign on my website, sanders.senate.gov. It's co-sponsored by Congressman Ted Deutsch of Florida. So we're making some progress. The other good news about that one, and I think I would hope that listeners get active in this issue, we have a number of cities and towns around the state that have passed resolutions urging the Congress to pass a constitutional amendment. Portland, Oregon, New York City, Los Angeles, Boulder, Colorado, Pueblo, Colorado, Duluth, Minnesota, Missoula, Montana, Oakland, California, Albany, New York, Burlington, Vermont, and I'm sure that there are others. A number of states now have resolutions in urging their state legislatures to demand that the Congress pass this constitutional amendment. So if you are concerned about American democracy, if you're concerned about not turning democracy into a commodity owned by large corporations and wealthy individuals, I hope that people will be involved in that issue. Let's turn very briefly to the State of the Union address the President gave a few days ago. I thought it had some commendable moments to it. I thought he raised some very important issues. I thought it had some weak spots as well. I think it is important, and I think the President did the absolutely right thing by reminding the American people where we came from. The idea that the Republicans are attacking Obama for the weak economy when under Bush, after 8 years, we lost 500,000 private sector jobs, median income, median family income significantly declined, and they laid the groundwork for the Wall Street collapse. It's really quite without shame that these guys have no shame that they will attack Obama when he inherited an economy that was losing 700,000 jobs a month. Should we be doing more? Should Obama and the Congress be doing more to create jobs? Absolutely. Our infrastructure is collapsing. We have the potential to rebuild roads, bridges, our rail system, water systems, antiquated schools. We can do that and create millions of jobs. We can create jobs by transforming our energy system away from fossil fuel. We can create jobs by changing our trade policy so that corporations can't shut down in America and move to China. Now, it was an interesting piece in the New York Times a week or so ago talking about the fact that some companies, General Electric and others, are bringing manufacturing jobs back to the United States. That's the good news. The bad news is, and the President did not discuss it, that in some cases these jobs are now paying 20, 30, 40% less than they used to. And one of the spokesmen for GE was talking about how they can now bring jobs back to America or grow jobs in America because we're becoming competitive with China when you throw in transportation costs and so forth and so on. That is not a good state of affairs. That is a race to the bottom. So we want to rebuild our manufacturing base. We've lost 60,000 factories in the last 10 years, 10 million good-paying jobs, millions of good-paying jobs, several million, million. But you don't want to do it by seeing wages for the middle class go significantly down. And while we're on jobs, let me mention another issue that I and my staff have been working very hard on the last week, and that is trying to save the United States Postal Service. The fact of the matter is the Postmaster General came out with a plan, would have been a disaster, would have resulted in the shrinkage of at least 100,000 jobs, shut down 252 processing plants, closed over 3,000 small post offices all over this country, and slowed mail delivery significantly, which to my mind lays the groundwork for a death spiral. Because if you can't guarantee people their mail is going to get to its destination in a short period of time, I don't know why people will use the Postal Service. The Postal Service, in my view, needs a new business model. It needs to be more entrepreneurial. It needs to innovate. It needs to be competitive in the digital age. People are not using first-class mail. Use an email. That has to be recognized. We need changes. But the bottom line is we're fighting for a new type of post office, but one that can save over 100,000 jobs guarantee mail delivery all over this country, universal mail service, whether you're in New York City and on Wall Street or whether you're in a small town in the state of Vermont.
Yeah, and I noticed last week Google said that they're going to start tracking both your email and your web browsing activity, and so maybe there's an opportunity there for the post office to offer an email service that's, you know, separate. Who knows?
I agree. That is a very important issue.
Yep. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's Brunch with Bernie here on the Tom Hartman Program. America's Senator, Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov, taking your calls at our national town hall meeting right in a minute.
Keep me in mind. Somewhere down the road, you might get lonely.
Occupying the airwaves here on the Tom Hartman Program. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, our Brunch with Bernie hour. And Laura in Chicago, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, hi. Senator Sanders, you're my favorite politician in the whole world, I think. So I want to know what's going on with the panel, the economic panel that you have brought together, looking at how to phase out the Fed.
Well, it's not to phase out the Fed. It's to reform the Fed. And we will have legislation in, I think, within the month. And let me just say a little bit, a little word on that. During the Wall Street crisis, a lot of attention was paid appropriately enough on what Congress was doing with the TARP bailout. That was about $800 billion. No attention was paid to what the Fed was doing during that same time. We had, to make a long story short, we ended up getting an amendment into the Dodd-Frank bill to audit the Fed during that period, and it turned out that in a revolving loan fashion, the Fed had provided $16 trillion in very low interest loans to every major financial institution in America, central banks all over the world, individual corporations here in America, and wealthy individuals here in America. What that told me is, number one, obviously there's got to be a lot more transparency at the Fed. We've got to do away with conflicts of interest at the Fed, where people on regional banks, regional Fed banks, are also sitting in major financial institutions. If that's not a conflict of interest, I don't know what is. So they're making decisions that benefit their own private institutions. Thirdly, and maybe most importantly and most difficult, the Fed was incredibly aggressive in trying to stabilize the financial institutions during the crisis. Meanwhile, today, we have in real terms 15% of our people unemployed or underemployed or have given up looking for work, 25 million Americans. Is the Fed in any way as aggressive in trying to lower unemployment, which is one of their mandates, as they were in protecting the interests of large financial institutions? And the answer is obviously no. So what we will be doing, we've put together a committee of 20 progressive economists, and we will have legislation, I'm guessing in about a month, which will do two things. Talk about the need for structural reform on the Fed. How do you make the Fed more democratic, more responsive to the needs of working families rather than just big money interest in Wall Street? Number two, in the midst of this economic crisis, what is the best role the Fed can play in terms of creating jobs? So, Laura, that's what we're working on.
Kara in Marengo, Indiana. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you, Senator, for taking my question. As you may know, Indiana, it looks like, is going to become the first right-to-work state since Oklahoma. And in doing a lot of research looking at this, it looks like we're just going to be the right-to-work for low wages. I don't know. It just seems like there's more an attack on the middle class. And I am not union, but I did. My husband has been a union member for 30 years. And for the first 10 years of our married life, we worked on the farm, and we saw, you know, we could afford insurance even at $70 a month. Now insurance, if you, anywhere I try to get it, is over $900 and some dollars. So you can't be poor anymore. It's very hard to be poor and still have a type of life that is a quality life. And so what do you think about the right to work issue?
Thank you very much, Tara, for calling, and thanks for your explanation, I think, not only for what's happening in your life, but I think you're describing what's happening to millions and millions of people's of lives. I am pro-union. I am very much against right-to-work legislation, and I think what right-to-work legislation is about is just as Tara described it, it's right-to-work for less. One of the media spends time and politicians talk about, for good reasons, very high unemployment in America and how we deal with that. But we should not forget that the economic crisis is not just high unemployment, it is low wages. In the last 10 years, median family income has gone down by about $3,000. You have millions and millions of people today working for wages that are lower than they used to receive. You have young people getting into the labor market, starting their careers, earning less in terms of real dollars than their parents did. And what all of this is about, Tara, is a race to the bottom. And we are becoming, sadly enough, competitive with China in terms of wages. So what we have got to do is not only create jobs in America, and I've mentioned a few minutes ago how I think we can do it, rebuilding our infrastructure, transforming our energy system, making fundamental changes to our disastrous trade policies, which allow corporations to shut down in America and move to China and so forth and so on. So the question is not just gaining jobs, which we have to do, but it is also making sure those jobs pay people a living wage.
Bernie, in the minute we have till the break, any chance of repealing Taft-Hartley?
In this Congress?
Well, I mean, getting the ball rolling, getting people awake about it?
Well, yes, that we can do. But repealing it at this point, no. But I think you're right, Tom. I think it's an issue that should resurface.
Yeah, because it seems, I mean, you know, that was Harry Truman vetoed that, and that the Republicans only controlled that Congress for 2 years, and they overrode his veto, and it has, that was the peak of unionization, 35% in 1947 when Taft-Hartley was passed.
And I think the point that, you know, interestingly enough, Tara said she's not a member of a union, but what people should understand who are not members of unions is if unions fight to provide decent wages for their members, they're raising wages for all people.
Right.
Because non-union employers are going to have to pay a higher wage as well.
There you go. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, here on the Tom Hartman Program, 866-987-THOM, although all of our lines are slammed right now. So we'll be back with more of your calls for Bernie right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And get over to Bernie's site at sanders.senate.gov and sign his constitutional amendment. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you in the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, I don't think so. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, taking your phone calls. And Jack in Winterport, Maine, you're on the air with Bernie.
Good afternoon, Senator. I sure wish you represented Maine.
Thank you.
Hello?
Hi, right here.
Hi. What do you make of Mr. Geithner being our Secretary of the Treasury? Wasn't he part of the problem, major part of the problem that created the, with Goldman Sachs, created the mess we're in now?
Well, Jack, the short answer is yes. And I voted against Mr. Geithner to become Secretary of the Treasury. And I think if one of the strong criticisms that I have of the Obama administration is they have relied too heavily on guys who used to work in Wall Street or the New York Fed, as was the case with Geithner. I think we need a new thinking in terms of people who get to high places in terms of providing advice to the president on financial matters, whose job is to protect the middle class and working families. I think people like Elizabeth Warren, we worked very, very hard to get Elizabeth Warren into the White House. And I think we need a lot more folks like that who understand what it means for a middle class in this country to be collapsing, who are advocating for policies to create decent-paying jobs in America, to protect consumers who are getting ripped off by credit card companies and banks in terms of mortgages. The short answer to your question, Jack, is I voted against Mr. Geithner to become Secretary of the Treasury.
Ken in Great Falls, Montana, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call, Senator. I'm concerned about the XL pipeline. Here in Montana, both Democratic senators are for it. We sit here and we watch as Exxon Mobil tries to bring megaloads from South Korea through Idaho and up there. Work that used to be done by Americans is being done by South Koreans. But with the pipeline itself, I'm wondering if there's a way we could have a law or an amendment to some of the Republicans' bills that would put a tariff, or well, it'd be an export tax of say 30% to 40% on any oil exported from America until we're down to 20% imports. You know, this would be for American security. Mm-hmm. In other words, we take the rights language and we kind of give it back to them in a form.
Well,
by,
can you,
by having that, they would.
You are aware, I think, that this Keystone XL pipeline from Alberta to Texas, Alberta, Canada to Texas, as I understand it, that oil will be going to Asia, not into the United States at all.
So we should put an export tax on that oil.
Right, right. I hear what you're saying, right. But I want everybody to understand that despite Republican talking points on this issue, this is oil that is going to be exported. And what Ken is talking about is perhaps a tariff on that. But I would say, Ken, I am opposed and helped lead the opposition successfully to the XL pipeline because, A, this is filthy oil which would emit 80% more greenhouse gas emissions than the normal excavation of oil. And if we are serious about addressing the great environmental crisis of our time and of our planet, which is global warming, we cannot be digging up oil, excavating oil, which will result in a huge amount of greenhouse gas emissions. As I have said many times, and I believe very strongly, the future of energy in this country is energy efficiency. And if we can get cars up to 55 miles per gallon in the year 2025, which is an absolutely achievable goal, you will have saved three times more oil than the XL pipeline produces, oil which is going to China. So the real future, I think, is energy efficiency. New technologies are there, not only in automobiles and trucks, but in terms of weatherization of our buildings. We are making some progress in Vermont. We have a long way to go, but you have homes in Vermont who have been weatherized that are saving 20, 30, 40%. We're seeing that kind of reduction in fuel consumption. People are saving money and cutting back on greenhouse gas emissions. And I think there's huge potential in terms of wind, solar, geothermal, biomass, and other developing technologies. So that's where I'm coming from in terms of the XL pipeline.
Danny in Los Angeles, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. I think there should be a law that makes the corporate decision makers and board members held accountable by being arrested, having to post bail, and doing jail time, and not by being fined. No, the fines do nothing to deter their illegal activities because the fines are just a fraction of the profit that they make by intentionally breaking the law. And if corporations want to be seen as people, then the corporate leaders should be doing jail time when they break the law and not just be getting fines.
Well, Danny, I think you raise an interesting and I think reasonable position. I think the facts are pretty clear. I mean, if you look at Wall Street, for example, one can make the argument, and I believe, that what happened during the crisis was not only reckless, it was illegal. I think you had a lot of illegal acts on Wall Street. People knew what they were doing in selling products that were worthless. And I think one of the reasons the American people are as angry as they are is you have the greed and illegal behavior on Wall Street causing this recession, which has led to so much pain and misery in this country, massive unemployment, people losing their homes, people losing their life savings, and people are saying, well, how many of these guys on Wall Street actually went to jail? You know? And the answer is very, very, very few. So I think Danny's point is well taken. Fines for a mega billion-dollar corporation is just the cost of doing business. And I think if these people who commit crimes intentionally and are ripping off the American people had to do some jail time, they might think twice about their actions.
Chuck in Mount Prospect, Illinois. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom and Bernie. Listen, one thing I admire about both of you is that you always take the political high ground. But over the past 12 years, people like Karl Rove and Frank Lutz have been able to frame the debate. And I'm proposing that no one uses the phrase 1% anymore. It's the Romney class. I think that would resonate with voters. What do you think?
A new frame.
Well, it's not just Romney. It's Romney, of course, is part of the top 1 or 2%. But it's not just Romney. I think what is important to understand, and the American people, Chuck, are beginning to catch on to this, is that while the middle class declines and poverty increases, the people on top are doing phenomenally well. And I credit the Occupy Wall Street movement for forcing the media to talk about income and wealth inequality in America. That's an issue some of us have been talking about for a long time. Tom has been talking about it. I've been talking about it. But not a whole lot of elected officials or the media have been talking about it. Today you have the 400 wealthiest people in America owning more wealth than the bottom half of America, 150 million people. Top 1% earns more income than the bottom 50% of the American people. So I think focusing on the issue of the growing disparity between the people on top who are doing phenomenally well, whose effective tax rate is the lowest in decades, and everybody else is appropriate. So I applaud the Occupy Wall Street people who have framed that issue as the 1% versus the 99%.
Brooke in Hagerstown, Maryland. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you for taking my call, Senator Sanders. I just wanted to ask you about how Obama was talking about Made in America and fixing U.S. manufacturing in a State of the Union address, but the trade policy his administration is making would have the exact opposite effect. In fact, the new negotiations that he's going through with the Trans-Pacific Partnership would actually ban Buy America provisions and reward job offshoring. And as a member of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, I was wondering if you and the Progressive Caucus would provide some leadership to stop this trade deal before it rolls back what you're working for.
Well, Brooks, I agree with you. I think the president, appropriately enough, talked about manufacturing. There is an uptick in terms of manufacturing jobs. As I mentioned earlier, many of those jobs actually are paying lower wages than used to be the case in manufacturing. We've lost 60,000 factories in the last 10 years. So I'm glad that the president is focusing on manufacturing, which has used to be, especially if you had a union job in manufacturing, the ticket to the middle class in America. That was the gold standard of working class jobs. And we have lost many of them. But Brooks is right in saying that so long as we have this disastrous trade policy, which allows companies to shut down and move to low-wage countries, I don't believe that you are going to create decent-paying manufacturing jobs in America.
It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. Check out sanders.senate.gov and sign his constitutional amendment.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
You can also drop into our live chat room and our blogs and message boards and things over at TomHartman.com as well. TomHartman.com, Sanders.Senate.gov. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. Chris in Vernon, New Jersey, listening on iHeartRadio. Cool. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Thanks for taking my call. It's great to speak with you again, Bernie. I've been watching the debates, and I believe they call it television programming for a reason, because it's programming us. So how will we ever have a president who doesn't believe corporations are people when the corporations own all the media and have a humongous influence over how people think?
But Chris, I mean, you're raising it's a very important issue, and that is, you're getting beyond the day-to-day issue of politics into the culture of America. And what I get very upset about is you can turn on television in some cases and maybe have good cable and get 50 different stations and there's almost nothing to watch. There is Chris's point is well taken, that when you turn on television, what you are watching are stations owned by large corporate conglomerates. And I'm not just talking about Rupert Murdoch and Fox. You're talking about Disney and ABC. You're talking about Viacom and CBS and Disney and Comcast and NBC. These are huge corporate entities, and they have their agenda, and you have to be pretty naive not to understand that. So I think one of the things that we are fighting for, and Chris asked the right question, is you got to fight for a progressive media. And the fact that we have the Tom Hartman Show. Tom, how many people are listening or watching the show?
Well, it used to be 3 million when we were just on commercial radio stations. We haven't been able to measure our non-commercial stations, but we've more than doubled the size of our audience based on our calls. So,
well, you know, what Tom is doing is extraordinarily important, and I hope everybody supports the efforts of Tom Hartman and the other progressive talk show hosts. We're making some progress on MSNBC. But the fight has got to be, A, to demand that corporate media allow more progressive voices to be heard, but B, to grow progressive media as well. And in recent years, we've had a little bit of progress. But the reality is, it's not just television. Tom, what do we think? 90% of talk radio is right wing?
Oh yeah, and it's probably 99% if you were to do it by hours, you know, hours of programming versus number of people programming.
So for every hour of a Tom Hartman or an Ed Schultz or other progressive talk show people, you have, you know, 10 times as many right wing folks.
Right.
And I think one way that we can deal with that is people should go to their local radio stations. One of the things that always blows my mind is you have cities in America where Republicans get 20 or 25% of the vote. And yet, that's all you can get is right-wing radio. And I think we've got to fight to change that, but mostly in one way or another. We've got to continue the fight for progressive media. Tom, why don't you jump in on that one?
Well, I just, you know, if you're listening or watching, you know, call your local the TV station, the radio station, and let them know that you're watching and participating. If there's a sponsor, let them know. I mean, that's how you support progressive media and interact on it. And that's my pitch. Should we go to the next call, Bernie?
Yeah.
Okay, Tom in Woodville, Alabama. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you, Tom and Senator Bernie. My question is, seeing that the election with George Bush and Dick Cheney and was stolen in both the election, what are we going to set up some kind of committee this time to monitor this next election, seeing all the money is being pumped into it?
Well, Tom, you raised a good question. I think the Supreme Court decision, which gave the election to George W. Bush, was an outrage. And what we are concerned about right now at this moment is the voter suppression efforts that are going on in a number of right-wing states who are doing their best to make it very, very difficult for low-income people and for senior citizens to vote. The good news in America is we have very, very little voter fraud. And I think anyone who commits voter fraud should be severely punished. But what governors and legislatures all over this country are doing in the name of combating a non-existent voter fraud is making it harder and harder for people to vote if they don't have photo IDs, and making it difficult for them to get, or expensive for them to get, those photo IDs. So that is an issue that we are working on right now to make sure that millions of people are not denied the right to vote.
Okay, Susan in Seattle. Hey, Susan, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. I want to talk about the post office. Is part of your bill that you're working on removing the requirement that the post office fund the pension plans for 75
yes.
years? Congress did that. They can take it away.
That is the central part of it. Let me say a word about that. What Susan is talking about is one of the reasons. I mean, the post office has to deal with the real reality. The first-class mail is down, being replaced by email. That is true. But what Susan is talking about is an incredibly onerous provision put in by Congress in 2006 that says the post office has to come up with $5.5 billion every single year for future health care retiree benefits. That is absolutely onerous. No other agency of government comes close to that. Nobody in the private sector has to do that. So, Susan, yes, that is absolutely
one of the issues that my legislation is dealing with.
Bernie, we still have calls from California to Missouri to Vermont, but we only have a minute left. So it's can you wrap up the show here?
Yeah, I think a couple of things. As I think about the calls that came in, we started the show with calls coming in from Terry and Loretta from Maine and Vermont and Tara from Indiana. And these are working class folks who are struggling right now. And I think in the midst of all of the speeches that you hear from the White House in terms of economic recovery, yeah, the economy is a hair better. That's good. Very good. And you talk about here all these Republicans who talk about trickle-down economics, a theory that has never worked. Let us not forget for one moment ever that there are tens and tens of millions of families right now who are struggling incredibly hard to keep their heads above water economically. We did a study. There are seniors today who are going hungry. We have kids who are sleeping out on the street. Let us focus on how we create an economy that works for all of our people and not just the big money interests, which is certainly the case right now.
So well said, Bernie. Thanks so much for being with us again this week.
Good to be with you, Tom. Thank you.
Always great. Check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything goes Friday, although there's a lot in the news. You know, when the super committee crashed, there was these automatic cuts in the Pentagon that went into place. This was part of the deal where they said, okay, you know, the Republicans will never let the super committee crash because of that. Well, it happened. And weirdly enough, the Pentagon, I mean, they're, you know, they announced yesterday, I guess it's in today's papers, that almost $1 trillion in cuts over the next 10 years. Part of it is going to be dialing back on retirement pay for military. And I think instead what we should be doing is saying to the war profiteers, you know, FDR once said, there will never be a, you know, we will not have another war millionaire as a result of the present conflict. He was talking about World War II. And instead, we've got all these war millionaires. So that's happening. I say, you know, I agree with him. No more war millionaires. Welcome to America, by the way. Oh, you have that clip? Oh, here it is, right here.
Our present emergency and a common sense of decency make it imperative that no new group of war millionaires shall come into being in this nation as a result of the struggles abroad.
There you go. No new war millionaires. So, you know, if you're going to cut the Pentagon, instead of cutting the retirement pay of the military, how about cutting out the war millionaires? They're crawling all over this town. So, anyhow, goodbye Newt Gingrich. Last night he really blew it in the debate. It's not that he blew it, but he just, you know, actually I don't think that he ever, what I think has been going on here through this whole thing from the very beginning is that the media hypes up whatever candidate is down and pushes down whatever candidate is up to try and get it as close to a horse race as possible so that lots and lots of advertising dollars will have to be spent on TV stations and TV networks. And they keep that horse race going to keep the ratings up. That's my personal opinion. And, you know, Newt's toast now. Romney's going to win this thing. He's going to be the nominee. He basically said last night he's going to ask Marco Rubio to be his vice president. And I've already, you know, it's been a year now I've been saying that. We're going to have a Romney-Rubio ticket. And that's going to be a tough one. Don't underestimate this thing. That's going to be a very tough one. The Hispanic vote in the United States is real substantial, and Marco Rubio on that ticket with Mitt Romney could present a significant challenge to the president. And we'll see if Joe Biden stays on the Democratic ticket. I mean, there's some possibilities, some changes there, too. Who knows? New survey by the Kaiser Family Foundation. Do you believe that the Supreme Court is unbiased? Most Americans say no. Nah, they're you know. These guys, come on, Clarence Thomas, Scalia, the whole bunch of them, actually, but those two in particular, as well as John Roberts, or Sam Alito, excuse me. Sam Alito is the one who's been, you know, taking gifts from right-wingers and giving speeches and getting fees, and Clarence Thomas's wife working for the Heritage Foundation and all this kind of stuff, and the Federalist Society, and nobody believes anymore that these guys are anything other than right-wing hacks. Sad news. Sad news. And TransCanada, they've been hyping this thing, you know, 20,000 jobs. They've been putting out these estimates that the Republican politicians in the United States, quote, to promote the Keystone XL pipeline. Greenpeace is suing them for lying. This is so cool. They're suing, Greenpeace is suing TransCanada, the company that wants to sell its oil to the big oil refineries down in Texas so that they can convert it to gasoline. Keep in mind, the number one export of the United States, manufactured export of the United States right at this very moment is gasoline. And they want to export even more of it. It's very profitable. And we get to take all the risk. We get to take all the pollution. We get to take all the poison. So all that said, anyhow, it is Anything Goes Friday. We take your calls on any topic. And Middleton in Ono, West Virginia. Hey, Middleton, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom.
Good afternoon.
I was calling about the thing that I ran in yesterday. I'm 65, and I had to go get my driver's license renewed yesterday. And I was wondering if the other states has this same thing that you have to do. You know, in 2006, when they passed the law about ID restoration for everybody in the country.
Right. Well, it's been state by state, actually. But, yeah, I know what you're talking about. You're talking about the national, the standard, the ID standards for the driver's licenses. Yeah, okay, I got that.
Yeah, and I had to go show four things to show that, you know, I had to show my birth certificate, and then I have my driver's license, already got my picture on it.
Yeah.
You know, it's my photo, so it's me. And then I had to show two more of where my residence was, and they take your fingerprints off of both of your index fingers. And they photocopy all of that stuff to put that in the registry. So, you know, they're taking away all of your privacy. You know, it's making, you're not a private person anymore. You're public because you're put up in the registry so that they can come and get you anytime they want to because they know exactly where you're at.
Well, even more than that, they're making it harder and harder for you to get ID. And for people, you know, I don't own a car. And so there's really no reason for me to have a driver's license other than as ID. So, you know, and there's a lot of people in Washington, D.C., and a lot of people in New York City, and a lot of people in a lot of large cities that have good mass transit systems that tend to be Democratic voting and Democratic leaning who don't have driver's licenses. And they're just throwing these barriers there. And this is all about trying to reduce the number of people voting in those areas where they might vote Democratic. That's really what's going on, Middleton. Middleton, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Vic in Pittsburgh, Missouri. Hey, Vic, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Boy, you hit it right on the head as far as all this taking away the money as far as in the military. I personally believe that bring back the old military. I was part of the original volunteer military back in Ronald Reagan. I first joined. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you something, that it was all military. It was no private contractors whatsoever.
Yeah.
Maybe a few, but a handful.
Yeah.
But it is nothing but a profit thing, and I believe this thing about cutting soldiers is the biggest mistake they can ever do.
Yeah. Well, it was originally written into law as a way of saying, you know, this is going to be so draconian. You guys better not let that super committee fail. And, you know, what Congress has done, Congress can undo. And I'm guessing that they will probably fix this in this legislative session. But I just find it mind-bogglingly ironic and frankly, tragic. You know, if they really wanted to go after the Republicans, frankly, instead of saying that they're going to cut into military pensions, they should have said that they were going to cut into defense contractors because that's who's funding them. Vic, thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Patrick in Federal Way, Washington. Hey, Patrick, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. I got a simple question. If Obama wins a second term, do you think we'll start seeing some prosecutions of war criminals and fraud criminals, bankster criminals?
I think, he's already he's doing some real significant investigations of the banksters right now. And the Justice
Department. It's not always the banksters that should be the focus of attention. I think we got a lot of politicians that are just outright traitors.
Well, with you know, I don't know that there will be investigations of politicians. If you're talking about the war criminals, the old Bush administration people, no, I doubt that he'll ever go after them. No, you know, Bill Clinton didn't go after George Bush Senior or Ronald Reagan when he had an opportunity to for the crimes that they've committed.
Well, when they protect criminals, don't that make them accomplices?
Arguably, it does, and I think that this is a terrible precedent that was established by Gerry Ford when he pardoned not only Richard Nixon but a whole bunch of other people around him, and pardoned him not just for his Watergate crimes but for everything else. So his taking a $500,000 bribe from Jimmy Hoffa in the Sun Valley land deal back in 1950, he was pardoned for that. You know, any crime that we might find out about. And ever since then, every president has basically ignored the crimes of previous presidents. And I think it's a terrible way to govern the country. But, you know, I'm not, you know, tight enough inside the establishment that I'm the guy sitting around saying to President Obama, here's what you should do. And probably that's a good thing. 15 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Anything Goes Friday. By the way, what do you think should be the caption on that photo of Jan Brewer shaking her finger at a President Obama?
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes.
Anything Goes Friday, 20 minutes past the hour. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
Oh, I just wanted to talk about employee-owned companies. I read something very interesting about a company called Scott Bader Corporation. Actually, it's called Scott Bader Limited, but it's a company that started in 1950 by a Quaker owner, Ernst Bader. It's still around. It's grown now. It's in, I believe, three different areas of the world. It's grown quite big. And, you know, there was an article in the Telegraph, which you can get online, and what was interesting about it was they said that the thing that they noticed, this was a person from a school in Oxford that apparently a business school, and he had said that the research indicated that there was far less stress involved in these, you know, in other words, people are much happier working.
Right.
In the,
it's like the company is a union shop on steroids, because everybody who works there not just has a say in the place like a union would, but actually owns the place.
Right. And there is another company that's associated with the Cleveland Clinic that is an employee-owned company that services their laundry. Mm-hmm. And it's been incredibly successful, in the,
yes.
And it has turned around the lives of a lot of people in that area who have lost their jobs, were losing their homes, and now have a job that has benefits and whatnot and is paying a decent wage. And that was mentioned in Fixing the Future. I recommend that to anybody. It was a piece done by David Brancaccio, and he covered that, some businesses in Washington State. One was associated with the Lummi tribe that processes it's fish. The salmon. It's a salmon fishery. And also different food co-ops that have been incredibly successful. I was going to call in earlier and talk to Bernie. I mean, I think these companies need to be encouraged even more by being given different types of tax breaks, because they are, you know, in this program, Fixing the Future, they did show how they could turn around the economy and, you know, through a Main Street effort rather than a Wall Street effort, regrow the economy by each of these businesses in turn starting out new businesses. I just wanted to mention that to you.
Yes, there's a couple of different classifications here. There are employee-owned businesses. There are employee-owned cooperatives that can be nonprofit or for-profit. There are customer-owned businesses, which is your health food store, that are not employee owned, but they're owned by their customers, and that's starting to grow now in areas like the health, the not just the food field, but the services industries like the health industry, and then there's large scale cooperatives like the largest. The last chapter in my book, Rebooting the American Dream, is all about this. About this is an alternative to capitalism. Mondragon is the largest. It's a $15 billion a year corporation with tens of thousands of employees all over the planet. This is not capitalism. This is employee ownership, and you don't need capitalists for this to work.
Yes.
And it's not like everybody gets to be a capitalist. It's like everybody gets to be an owner of the company. And you're seeing this explode in Argentina, in Brazil. In Argentina, when they had the crash in 2000, I was down there in early 2001, and the people were occupying factories where the owners had simply said, "That's it, screw it, we're leaving the country." And the workers just said, "Okay, we'll take over the factory and we're running it." And in many states now, they're creating this thing called the B Corporation, as in benefit, which means that the corporation is established not for the purposes of making money, but for the benefit of the community and for the benefit of its workers. And they're creating different tax laws for these B corporations. There's only a few states that have done this so far. There's only about 20 states right now that even recognize worker-owned cooperatives. So you're absolutely right, John. Excellent point. Thanks for calling and making it. In Madison, Wisconsin, it's kind of the epicenter of this, by the way. Union Cab Company and the Isthmus Manufacturing Company, things like this. We need more of these, and we need more states to modify their corporate charter rules to allow for worker-owned cooperatives to have them recognized as a legitimate and separate form of business from a normal capitalist corporation. And this goes beyond ESOPs, the employee stock option program, and things like that. This is actual ownership. Linda in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, Linda, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. Good morning.
Hi.
The reason I'm calling, I became aware of NESARA, which is the National Economic Security and Reformation Act.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with it?
Maybe not. I'm not. Give me a little more information.
It was 1993.
Okay.
U.S. Supreme Court ruled on charges by the Farmers Union. And the banks in the U.S. were fraudulently foreclosing on farm mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the NESARA initiates peace immediately and provides forgiveness of credit card mortgage and bank debt and remedy to government frauds, abolishes IRS, initiates U.S. This was already put in the government, but we need people to take action to get it announced and implemented. It's NES.
It abolishes the IRS, and it's already part of our law?
Yeah, it restores constitutional law.
I think you're reading something on the internet that ain't quite straight.
Well, that's why I'm calling you.
Yeah, there are no laws that have abolished the IRS that have ever passed Congress. There have been attempts to do that.
The U.S. Supreme Court ruled.
No. The Supreme Court has not ruled that the IRS is unconstitutional.
Five justices spent years negotiating how the reformations would occur in agreements called accords with the U.S. government and the Federal Reserve Bank owners, with the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank.
Just because somebody wrote it on the internet doesn't make it true.
I know. That's why I'm calling you.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't believe everything.
Yeah.
I hear.
Well, this is something I would not believe, some of it sounds nice, but if we're going to have a society where we are functioning as a people, we're going to have some sort of tax collection agency. This sounds more like kind of a far-right, fringy thing. Linda, I'm sorry to burst the bubble, but thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
What did FDR warn us about? I'll tell you right after this. And your calls on Anything Goes Friday. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything Goes Friday. And Russell in Nampa, Idaho. Hey, Russell, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I have a really good caption for you for that picture with Jan Brewer and President Obama.
Okay.
And it's from the Wizard of Oz. I'll get those ruby slippers back.
Ha! That's a good one. Okay.
From a profile, she looks like the character.
I'll get those ruby slippers back. Thank you, Russell. I appreciate it. My, for what it's worth, mine was, you can't step any farther into this state until I see your birth certificate or your papers. I mean, fill in the blank. Anyhow, Mark in Palatine. Whoop. Got to click the right button. Mark in Palatine, Illinois. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Nice to talk to you. I work as an environmental scientist on the Enbridge oil spill in Marshall, Michigan, which happened in July 2010.
800,000 gallons.
Yeah, maybe EPA says closer to a million.
Wow.
We're still working on that. It's been a very interesting project. I think Enbridge is trying to do a good job. You know, it's a big Canadian pipeline company, but that is tar sand oil.
Yeah.
So we're getting it into this country now.
Oh, yeah. There's already a Keystone pipeline. I mean, it goes down to Missouri, and it goes across to Indiana, where they refine it. They refine some of it in Missouri. They refine some of it in Indiana.
And some of it in Illinois.
In Illinois.
A little spill there, too. But maybe you could come over there and look us up sometime.
Yeah. Well, I get over to Michigan occasionally, but you're absolutely right, and it's an excellent point. In fact, that oil spill, did they ever figure out what caused that?
Oh, the pipeline ruptured. There's a picture over there somewhere where there is a big rip in it. You know, it's pretty nasty stuff.
Yeah, this is the this is one of the worst. It was the worst environmental disaster in the Midwest, arguably since Lake Erie caught on fire. Okay. Thanks a lot for bringing it up, Mark, and keeping the memory alive, as it were. We've got to let people know about this. William in Stansbury Park, Utah. Hey, William, what's up?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
Just great.
Excuse me. I'm just calling because, you know, there's a dialogue that needs to be had in this country that no one's bringing that up, and that is what happened to all the money that people lost equity in their homes for. That money didn't just disappear.
Yes, it did.
It ended up in the hands of some very wealthy people, and if that's not the case, it strengthened the dollars. And those people who had a lot of dollars benefited, which is the same group.
Yeah.
Nobody's talking about that.
Well, what happens is
been stolen from the homeowners in this country.
Yeah, the money actually does vanish. I mean, when you have a loss in value, a loss in equity, arguably that money simply does vanish. The economy contracts, and the economy contracted by several trillions of dollars. On the other hand, you're absolutely right. What that does is it makes the dollars that are still there worth more, which is called deflation if it gets really bad. And that's why our interest rates are at zero. And you, as you correctly point out, those people who were heavy into cash rather than into property did well. You know, the Mitt Romneys of the world did very well, or if they were invested in bonds and things, which is why the bond market's been roaring along, you know, for the last couple of decades.
Right. And those people that are sitting on all the money, the big corporations are sitting on trillions, not even investing it in China, just sitting on it.
Yep. At least $2 trillion here in the United States, yes.
You know, the money's becoming worth more.
That's right. Yeah, I agree, William. And you know, this is the consequence of the weirdness of the business cycle and the weirdness of the economic policies that brought this about. I don't have an easy fix for it, but you've identified it correctly. Mark in Braintree, Vermont. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hello.
Yeah, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm just calling in about the deficit. People have been talking about cutting taxes you see they're raising taxes or cutting spending.
Yep.
Why not raise taxes, cut spending, and sell public assets?
I don't like
any of those ideas necessarily, but,
yeah.
I mean, when you're in the hole that you're in, you got to do what you got to do.
You might want to check out today's Financial Times. It's a really interesting article. I'm pretty sure it's on page 2. Might be on page 4. I read it in the paper this morning. I remember it's one of the inside pages about the guy who's running against Sarkozy in France. And thanks a lot for the call, Mark, for raising this topic. He is the socialist candidate. The socialist candidate was going to be Dominique Strauss-Kahn, DSK, the guy who was accused of raping the maid in New York. And so now, and he's went down in flames. And so now this guy who's running is like he's like a bookkeeper type, you know. I mean, he's very kind of low key, and nobody ever heard of him, and nobody knows who he is, and he's running on the socialist ticket, and he has pulled out ahead of Sarkozy in the polls. He's significantly ahead. He and his coalition are pulling like 60% of the vote right now. And in the Financial Times today, they pointed out that his platform, that the French people are saying, yes, let's go for that, is to stop with the austerity already, stop with the cuts already, and in fact, he wants to undo the giant tax giveaways that Sarkozy gave to the big corporations and to the rich people in France, undo those and you know, start taxing them again. And you know, take the economy back to where it was. And he's right. No country in history ever cut its way to prosperity. It is a fantasy. It is a religion. And it's wrong. Doris in Flint, Michigan. Hey, Doris, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Hey, I'm glad I got through to you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to talk. When Bernie Sanders was there, I wanted to try to get to him, but maybe you could bring it up. I was running around with my car painted Saver post office. I love my post office and so on. But as I thought about it, I thought, how the heck did that get passed? And I called the Library of Congress, and I talked to the librarian there, and I was telling her she knew the bills for each house. And what she said is, I said, I really want to know who voted for that.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, you know, you should actually read the whole bill, because, you know, bills have a lot of different things in them. And I said, she says a lot of things. And I said, I really wanted to see who voted which way, and she says, you won't find that out. I said, why not? And she says, because it was a voice vote.
Yeah.
And as I understood it, that anyone could ask for a roll call vote, but she said nobody did.
That's correct.
And so she said, you should look at the sponsors of the bill and then read through the discussion on the bill, and you get a better idea. And I asked her, well, who are any of the sponsors? And one of them was Henry Waxman, who's a Democrat and been, you know, for a lot of good things. And the other person I didn't know, and I haven't had time to download it, but you can go into the Library of Congress, and I wanted to know why nobody asked for a roll call vote on that one.
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to it. A lot of these things, particularly when the Republicans controlled the House or the Senate or both, a lot of these things just got jammed through. No discussion, nothing. In fact, when Pelosi came in, when Nancy Pelosi became Speaker, she said, okay, we're going to give every bill 3 days so people can at least familiarize themselves with it. Because very often the Republicans would hit the floor with something, and 20 minutes later they'd be voting on it. And
was
so
they,
it,
was
it,
that under the Republicans that that happened?
Yes,
under
yes, it was in 2006.
Finance?
Yeah, it was.
But someone could call for a roll call vote, right?
Yes, anybody can call for a roll call vote, and that forces it. And it
I
also
Bernie would know.
Yeah, Bernie, he probably would. I honestly don't know. And the other thing that I don't know, and this might have been what she was trying to caution you about, is whether that was slipped into another larger piece of legislation. For example, mm-hmm. the piece of legislation that blew up Glass-Steagall, or the piece of legislation the piece that blew up Glass-Steagall specifically, that was slipped into a larger bill. And so there's, you know, very often what you find is these little time bombs that go off down the road, and you say, where did that come from? What kind of idiot would have voted mm-hmm. for that? Well, you know, it was 15 lines that was inserted into a 4,000-page bill, and, you know, some omnibus spending bill or something, or Military Appropriations Act, something that was a guaranteed pass, and they slipped it in, and instead of it saying explicitly what it was all about, instead it says, you know, this bill modifies, Bill 301.4.7 of 1943 to change paragraph 9 to from to till. Right. Or something like that. And the only way that you can even figure it out is to like go back through the law books and it takes hours and hours and hours. And members of Congress don't have time to do that. They've got to do fundraising. So
right.
I mean, you know, tragic.
They have staff. They have staff.
Well, they have staff. But
staff do that.
But, you know, a lot of their staff is dealing with constituent requests and things like that. This is part of the problem. This is why, you know, I'm so opposed to term limits, for example, is that the permanent infrastructure in this city is the lobbyists. It has become the lobbyists. They're the permanent infrastructure in this city. And there's over 100 members of Congress now who are lobbyists. And there's a dozen that are going to be coming up in this next election who are, you know, big shot people. And they're going to be, and you know, who are retiring from Congress. And they're going to become lobbyists at $1 million a year, $2 million a year, because they've got the connections. And when they go to their old friends and they say, hey, why don't you slip this thing in? That's a nice piece of legislation you got there. Would you just put a couple lines in for me? Oh, yeah, sure. No problem. You know, we've been buddies for a long time. I trust you. And by the way, thanks for the check for the campaign. You know, that's how it works, and it shouldn't work that way. But that's how it works, and we need legislation to stop the revolving door. That we need legislation to say that members of Congress are doing public service, and if you're doing public service, and for the military as well. The other thing is that if you retire as a general, you know if you had anything to do with buying military hardware during your career and you bought a whole bunch of it from one of these big companies, that company will offer you a job that's going to pay you a whole hell of a lot more than you made as a general or anything else. And we've got to change that. I mean, this is the corruption of our system. It's become, I hate to quote Sarah Palin, but it's become crony capitalism. And obviously, that's not what she was talking about. But this is what it is. Right. Doris, thank you for the call. You really put the nail on the head, and I salute you for all the effort that you went through to find out the details on that piece of legislation. That's extraordinary. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
More bad news for John Kasich. Oh, and I was going to share with you what the warning from Franklin Roosevelt. We'll do that right after this break.
Oh, you turn out fine, but you got to keep your head up. Oh, and you can let your head down.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, helping you win the water cooler wars. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line, brought to you by Ellen Ratner's new book, Self-Empowerment. Hey, Victoria, what's up?
Well, Tom, it depends how you want to spin this, but the gross domestic product accelerated in the final 3 months of last year to a 2.8% annual rate. So that's good. It's the strongest pace of quarterly growth since the second quarter of. And it's close to 3% plus that economists say is got to be sustained to really pull us out of the 8.5% jobless rate. But
that's not the headline over a Drudge.
What does Drudge say?
Drudge says annual growth only 1.7%. We're in the tank.
Well, growth for all of 2011 was slower. It was 1.7%, and so it was slower.
So the
final quarter was fast.
Was fast, yeah, okay.
Right, so they're pleased about that. They're pleased that things look to be turning around. Things generally look to be getting better. So, you've got to admit it's getting better all the time, as the Beatles said.
so wonderfully said, yes.
So wonderfully said. Meantime, at the Democrats' retreat in Cambridge, Maryland, Vice President Joe Biden today saying that he was not going to get going on these guys. I know that's not appropriate, referring to Romney and Gingrich. Then proceeded to do so with gusto, without notes.
Really?
Yes.
What did he say?
Basically said that he castigated Romney for having said that automakers should be allowed to go bankrupt without a federal bailout, and castigated Gingrich for suggesting that some poor people didn't have strong work habits.
Mm-hmm.
But then he sort of provided a standard by which voters should judge the Obama administration. He said that he and President Obama had discussed a test for whether we brought the economy back. It's us changing the economic environment so that ordinary people can turn and look at their kid and say, honey, it's going to be okay. He added, people are tired of being tired.
Yeah, people are tired of being afraid, actually. I think
it's even
worse than that. And there's still more to come. I mean, this thing has not played out yet, because the structural stuff, the fundamental stuff that created this crash hasn't been totally, or even, I'd say, halfway remedied. But that's my commentary. Anyhow, back to you in the news.
He also said that Republican promises to return the country to a sort of market-oriented economy, very little government help for industry and for homeowners and people unable to afford college. He said that would help the Democrats. I think that's not just political theater or tactic. I really think they believe it. I know where it ends. It ends January the 20th of next year, when Barack and I are standing once again with a majority in Congress. And he got a standing ovation for that.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, Joe Biden is the politician's politician. He is such a good, he really knows how to work a crowd.
Well, he's being unleashed on the Rust Belt states and Florida and a couple of other states during the reelection campaign.
That's great. That's great.
That's where he will be. Meanwhile, the president today was explaining in some more detail one of his proposals in his State of the Union address, how his new college affordability proposal would shift federal funding away from colleges and universities that fail to keep tuition costs from rising.
That's interesting. You know, the colleges and universities that fail tend to be the for-profit ones. Do you think that there's an intentional association there? Most, you know, most of the defaulting student loans, the vast majority of them are from for-profit colleges.
I think he's talking about all colleges.
Yeah, but I believe you're right. But it's the biggest impact of a policy like that will be on the for-profit colleges.
Interesting. Yeah. Very interesting. So. He says that basically what he's going to do is he says students will receive the greatest government grants and loan support at colleges where they're likely to be best served, and little or no campus aid will flow to colleges that fail to meet affordability and value standards.
Very, very interesting.
Yes. He's also proposing a version of race to the top for the higher education system, whereby the administration would incentivize governors and state legislators to keep tuition affordable and improve student outcomes by creating a $1 billion competitive grant. Also, a $55 million competitive grant program for private and public colleges and nonprofit organizations that develop plans to boost higher education attainment and student outcomes.
That's great. I think the most important part of our infrastructure is our intellectual infrastructure, and it has been totally ignored since the Reagan presidency.
Well, with student debt now outpacing credit card debt, he's really wanting to address this.
Yeah, that's good. It's going to, and that'll bring young people into the political arena too.
So, and I think he's mindful of that.
Yeah, we're talking about your concerns here.
Meanwhile, violence in Syria has escalated sharply over the past 2 days. Heavy bloodshed reported today in at least 3 flashpoint areas. Arab League monitors are expressing exasperation, huge frustration, and the UN Security Council today, diplomats from Western and Arab nations are holding talks on a draft resolution that would condemn Assad's government. And there are expectations that a vote could be held next week. However, Assad's most important ally, Russia, is saying it will veto any resolution that calls for Assad to relinquish power. But this is a major step for the Security Council to be moving in this direction.
Yeah. Although, you know, sometimes the law of unintended consequences. Did you see the report about in Libya, the Medecins Sans Frontières, the Doctors Without Borders, are basically declaring a strike because they're seeing so many torture victims right now and who are being tortured right this minute, by the new post-Qaddafi government, that apparently it's there's a real horror show going on there. So, you know, beware of the law of unintended consequences.
That is horrendous.
Well, I think that, you know, if you have intervention, if you bring violence to a country to change its government, there's going to be continued violence. On the other hand, if it's a people's uprising from the bottom up, there's a different kind of outcome. But, I would hope that people...
And I don't think they're talking intervention at this point. And with so many defections from the army, it's looking more and more like a civil war.
I think you're right. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Not just the conservative ones. There's all kinds of ones, actually. By the way, Joyce lets me know, the California Assembly has a bill. It's called AB 1163 that would amend the corporate code in the state of California to allow for co-ops, co-op type of corporation in that state. That's a big deal. And as I said, I think it's fewer than 20 states in the United States have laws that actually allow co-ops, worker-owned businesses. This is an alternative to capitalism. And it has to be, every corporation has to come into existence by virtue of the Secretary of State, unless it's a federally chartered one, which requires an act of Congress, So basically, we need to amend all the state charter laws all around the country, and to allow for B-type corporations, benefit corporations, to allow for co-ops, things like that. And this is Assembly Bill 1163 in California. So if you live in California, call your state legislator, your state assembly person, and say, hey, get on that thing with the co-ops. Okay, I told you I was going to share with you President Roosevelt's warning to America. And this is, I've played this, you know, for those of you who are longtime listeners or viewers to the program, you know, over the last 9 years, I've played this many, many times. But it's been a while. It's probably been a year since I've played it. So here it is, Franklin Roosevelt warning from the grave, from the 1930s, warning you about what's going on right now.
Let me warn you, and let me warn the nation against the smooth evasion that says, of course we believe these things. We believe in Social Security. We believe in work for the unemployed. We believe in saving homes. Cross our hearts and hope to die. We believe in all these things. But we do not like the way the present administration is doing them. Just turn them over to us. We will do all of them. We will do more of them. We will do them better. And most important of all, the doing of them will not cost anybody anything.
Right. Beware of a chicken in every pot politic. Boy, did we see that on display in the Republican debate last night. In fact, Newt called Mitt out on it. You know, he's basically, you're running around every state, or maybe it was the other way around. It was Mitt called Newt out on it, saying, you're running around every state saying, in South Carolina, here's what you need. And in Florida, here's what you need. And yeah, chicken in every pot. That's absolutely it. Dennis in Kansas City, Missouri. Hey, Dennis, what's on your mind today?
Hey, glad to talk to you. My topic is about the North American Free Trade Zone,
mm-hmm.
And what I've got to say about it is that we got what we didn't bargain for rather than what we bargained for. And I'll just give you a little anecdotal evidence via Jennifer Granholm. She recently told a story on the air about dealings with Whirlpool or one of the washing machine makers. I think they're all about the same one now anyway. But when she was governor, she was trying to get to negotiate them keeping their factory open in her state. And they gave them tax breaks. They gave them free rent. They gave them this, that, and everything. And they had their meeting with the manufacturer representative, who went away to their board and came back 15 minutes later and said, boy, that is absolutely the best offer we've ever had, but you can't compete with $1.57 an hour like we're getting in Mexico.
Yeah.
And, you know, what this is leading to is what we outlawed years ago, sweatshops, which, you know, was one of the prime factors in the Civil War. I mean, that's how far backwards we're going.
Yep.
The key thing there is that we are not going to get these companies to voluntarily come back to manufacturing here. And the free trade agreement was about expanding our sales markets, not about opening sweatshops in another country where they are legal.
Right. It was supposed to be about expanding our sales, you know, our opportunities for sales,
yes.
But that's not quite how it worked out. That's how it was sold to us.
Yes. And so, you know, the bottom line is we were sold a bill of goods over that. And I would think that the only way we're going to do anything to fix this is if in Mexico there is a manufacturer whose headquarters is in Mexico, then, yeah, okay, that's a free trade partner. But if their headquarters is in Kansas City or Michigan or someplace like that, then by God, we ought to be taxing the hell out of them and make them exempt from the free trade.
If they're manufacturing offshore or overseas, Yeah, I'm with you, and this yes. is why, you know, I was boggled by the fact that about a quarter of all the money that flowed through Apple is profit. And if they were manufactured in the United States, it might be 5 or 10%, but hey, how much do you need, you know? 800,000 yep. jobs gone from the United States, it's crazy. And not just Apple. And again, it's not that these corporations are nasty or that their CEOs are evil or doing anything wrong. It's they're following the laws and the opportunities. The politicians have set this thing. Now, many of these politicians were bought off to set it up. And long before Apple came along, not to, you know, I don't mean to turn this into Apple bashing, but and in fact it's, I don't intend it as, but the corporations that continue to say, oh no, you got to keep, you know, let's not go back to protectionism here, let's not protect the American worker, we got to protect transnational corporate profits, but not the American worker. I am not with that point of view. Dennis, very, very well said. Rich in Portland. Hey, Rich, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Curious about maybe a thought regarding, you know, some of the right-wing conservatives in the nation. It just seems, I wonder what your thoughts are on the possibility of a trend that with, you know, the advent of the Internet, computers, and you balance that next to a lot of senior citizens that aren't interested in the Internet or any type of progressive reading at all. But in a morbid way, I'm kind of curious that as the seniors die off and over the next 10, 20 years, do you by chance see a pattern changing at all with our younger people being able to grow up more informed?
Of course. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. There's an upside and a downside, but one of the things that we're seeing is that racism, for example, explicit, overt, aggressive political racism is something that's pretty much limited to people over 40, and people under 30. You know, in many parts of the United States, they look at that going, what? For example, I think that's because they've been exposed to, you know, people even who just grew up in a community of a single color, been exposed to multiple colors over the last few decades on television. But the problem with social media is that people tend to form silos. They tend to only talk to people who share their political views. They only read the websites that share their political views, and they don't engage in dialogues or discussions or debates with people of opposite political views. And thus, it's like people are talking in code. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, I go on Fox News and they'll start yelling at me about Dodd-Frank, and I'm like, wait a minute, you know. Dodd-Frank?
Yeah.
Dodd-Frank is what caused the audit of the Fed, you know? Oh, no, it's a terrible thing, you know?
Well, if I could add, you know, I was raised by mostly my grandparents who were extremely conservative and quite racist, and I'm in my 40s, so it's interesting you mentioned that, people over 40. And racism was a real bad thing, and I learned early on that I didn't care for that. I knew at the age of 11 that I didn't care for that.
Yep.
However, because of influence, I was still listening to Rush Limbaugh at 20 years old.
Yeah.
And it took me probably another 5 years, 10 years, and then by the time the Internet came out, I became informed, and I've completely switched. So I'm just kind of waiting for that trend to bounce around.
I think it's going to happen, Rich. I think the Occupy Wall Street movement is another manifestation of it. Thanks for the call.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here. Anything Goes Friday. Back with your calls and thoughts. And Mitt Romney's Bain Capital. Anything Goes Friday. Just got an email from President Obama saying, what do you want to ask me? I mean, you know, I'm sure he sent it to me and maybe 3 million of his best friends. But the question I have is, what's the caption on that picture of Jan Brewer with her finger up in his face, you know, and he's holding that envelope in his hand that she handed to him? How would you caption that picture? I'm just asking. Paul at Irvine, California. Hey, Paul, thanks for listening to KTLK. Kate Hawk, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I'm going to take off the call. Hold on.
Thank you.
I got a quick comment and a question.
Mm-hmm.
My comment is, for all your Simpsons fans out there, there's a scene where Homer makes Bart look at a picture of Nelson because they're in a golf tournament. He tells him to hate that picture. And Bart starts to squint his face and he starts to growl, but then he gets tired and he stops. And I think that's the metaphor for the Republican Party and their gay bashing with Rick Santorum and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So my question to you is, how long do you think the right wing can keep us hating foreigners, immigrants, poor people, gay people, how long do you think that's going to work for them in the future?
I think that as long as the economy stinks, they're going to have a fairly easy time promoting the hate of immigrants and promoting the hatred of poor people. I think promoting the hate of gay people is evaporating quite rapidly for the right. And again, and people of other races, you know, just general that, you know, minorities, any kind of minority, that's fading away. It's amazing how much America has changed just in my lifetime. And, you know, from the status of women to the status of people of color to the status of gays. And, but the economy really makes it easy. When you've got a bad economy, it really makes it easy to have the politics of division, to say, this is the guy, these are the guys responsible. It's those brown people from Mexico who are trying to take your jobs, or that kind of thing, you know. So I think it's gonna come with an economic recovery. And as generations pass, one of the wonderful things about America, and Paul, thanks for the call. One of the wonderful things about America is that ever since our founding, we have always been, I mean, you know, we slide backwards from time to time, but by and large, for 230-plus years, we have always been moving forward when it comes to granting more and more human rights and being a more and more progressive society. And I find that actually very inspiring. I'm very pleased about that. Sue in Arlington, Texas. Hey, Sue, what's up? Sue? Sue's not there. Okay. How about Bill in Clifton, New Jersey? Hey, Bill.
Yeah, hey, Tom. It's a real pleasure. I guess since this is Friday, I can discuss this, but you had talked before about anatomical differences between people with a conservative brain and, I guess, I don't want to say normal, but other kinds of brains.
Are you calling about that study that came out last week or earlier this week that people with lower IQs are more likely to be conservative politically and bigoted?
No. Well, I'm talking more about from like months ago with the MCDOA, where they have enlarged MCDOAs in conservatives because of the presence of large amounts of cortisol.
Right.
And
in utero, yeah.
Right. And what happens if we discover that a large part of our population is somewhat sociopathic or somewhat drawn to it? How does that affect all men are created equal if there are actually physical or physiological differences?
I think that first of all, everybody knows, including Thomas Jefferson, that all men aren't created equal. That the point of that was that politically we're trying to establish a country where everybody has equal opportunity. And and because everybody's not equal, because, for example, white people are born with 400 years of white privilege and black people are born with less than a generation in most cases of a strong black middle class in their own family history, and that's only true of even, you know, a portion of the black community, the African American community. It's incumbent upon society to try to equalize the playing field, to make up for the fact that everybody doesn't have equal opportunity. Everybody literally is not born equal, and so, you know, we try to balance the playing field out a little bit. And
yeah,
so. Makes sense.
But my worry is it becomes a real divisible thing. I don't know if you remember or go back to World War II.
I don't remember it. No. It happened long before I was born.
Okay. Well, out of books, Hitler's Willing Executioners, that Mengele had to go to his superiors to get permission to do these disgusting experiments on live human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And the flack that he got in the beginning back from them wasn't of a moral point of view, that you shouldn't be doing this to other human beings. It was that they thought that Jews had a different physiology,
right,
and that they would not be good test subjects.
Yeah, that was, and that played into that whole racial difference thing that the Nazis were promoting.
Right. There's still places in the South where people thought Jews had horns, for real.
Yeah.
And so anything that's physiological or different that way, like being black or anything, always plays a big role in it. So
it does.
I hope that this doesn't. There might be one good thing though. There's also been tests done on implanting emotions. In other words, they took rats and they were able to actually record the emotional brain frequency and then play it into another rat, and it would behave that way.
That's interesting.
If they could do things like that with maybe autistic people or people who don't experience emotions, maybe it could change their lives. And,
yeah, there are some really good people, Steve Larson, Nora Gagaudis, others who are doing brilliant work with EEG neurofeedback that is kind of a variation on that, where you find the frequencies that work for you. In fact, I went through this with Nora when I lived in Portland. She's a feedback neurofeedback practitioner in Portland. And, you know, hooked me up to this machine and fed back to me my own frequency that helps me get to sleep, so that, because I was doing this morning show where I had to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to do the show on KPOJ. And going to sleep at 7 p.m. is something that I've never been able to do. And by using this machine, she taught me how to put myself to sleep. It was pretty amazing. So, yeah, I think that, you know, there's that. That's the wonders of technology. And Bill, thanks for the call. The downside of the differences of us, well, that's a whole other discussion. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, a new vocabulary word with the good, the bad, and the ugly, and your calls on Anything Goes Friday. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very pantophagously ugly. The good. Newark, New Jersey Mayor Cory Booker. Booker called into a New York City radio show in response to comments New Jersey Governor Chris Christie made about letting voters decide, excuse me, whether gay and lesbian people should be allowed to marry in the state. Christie argued people would have been happy to have a referendum on civil rights rather than fighting and dying in the streets of the South, end quote. In response, Booker said, I wouldn't be where I am today if the states had voted on equal rights legislation for African Americans. Booker went on to say that while some things are fine to be put on the ballot for a public vote, issues that seem to be explicitly guaranteed by the Constitution, like equal rights, should not be left up to the public to decide. He's right. The bad. GOP talking head TV talking head Angela McLaughlin. On Friday morning's edition of Fox and Friends, McLaughlin had some harsh words for President Obama's political rhetoric in invoking taxing the wealthy in the build-up to the 2012 elections. She said, that's what liberals do. They do race baiting and class warfare. End of quote. Well, there is class warfare in our political atmosphere, but it's the Republicans that don't want the wealthy to pay their fair share of taxes. And as Warren Buffett said, it's his class, the rich class, that's winning. As for race baiting, it seems McLaughlin is experiencing selective amnesia. How could she forget how Newt Gingrich won South Carolina with race baiting, referring to President Obama as the food stamp president and calling unemployed African Americans lazy? Nice try, GOP TV. And the very, very ugly Peoria, Arizona Police Sergeant Pat Shearer. The U.S. Secret Service is investigating Shearer after he posted a photo online showing teenagers with guns posed next to a bullet-sprayed T-shirt with a picture of President Obama. The picture was posted on Shearer's Facebook page on January 20th, just a week before President Obama visited the state and had his now infamous conversation with Governor Jan Brewer. When questioned about his choice to post the photo online, Shearer told a local TV station, I don't think that the shooting of that T-shirt is that big a deal. It's more of a political statement. It's not like we're going to go out and shoot the president. Yeah, still, it's rhetorically not what's needed, especially when the president receives 30 death threats a day, according to the Secret Service, and especially when it's a member of our law enforcement that's making those threats or even implicitly making those threats. That's very, very ugly. Amazing. amazing. Okay, Julie in New York City. Hey, Julie, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say I love your show. My husband and I tune in every night on RT.
Thank you.
And what I wanted to say to you is, I just finished teaching Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath to my 12th grade students. I've taught that book for many years. It's my favorite novel.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure you're familiar with it.
I haven't read it since high school, but I remember the story, yeah. And
well, Steinbeck's message against corporate greed and moral decay is as relevant today as it was back then.
Yes.
And I basically wanted to tell you that I would often find myself coming home from teaching the novel and turn on your show, and whatever you happen to be discussing on air was so applicable to what I was discussing with my students about capitalism and just the nature of the economy. And I, you know, there's this one chapter in the book that I love so much that I would love for you to reread at your leisure, which is chapter 14, where Steinbeck references Lenin, Marx, Jefferson, Paine, and he says about, you know, you who own the things people must have, could, if you could understand this, you could separate, and if you could separate causes from results, if you could know that Paine, Marx, Jefferson, Lenin were results, not causes, you might survive. But that you cannot know.
Wow.
So the quality of owning freezes you forever into I and cuts you off forever from the we. So, you
wow.
know, he was, it's just so powerful and so
yeah.
relevant.
Yeah.
And, I just wanted to say that we love your show and just keep doing what you're doing.
Well,
I'm so glad that, you know, I have to say, like, honestly, I was not, I didn't know about you for many years. I'm newly exposed to, your work, and I'm going to read your books, and I just think you're great.
Well, thank you very much, Julia. It's very kind. Let me, as a fellow Steinbeck aficionado, since I think around 2006, every month, more or less, I've missed a couple, but I've been writing a book lately, and so I haven't had so much time. But about every month, I write a book for book review for BuzzFlash.com, which is a progressive website that supports itself by selling books. And about 5 years ago, four or more, it was right around the time my dad was dying, and I went back to Michigan, and he was reading Steinbeck's Cannery Row.
Mm.
And when he died, I was stayed in the house for a couple of days, you know, waiting for the funeral and all that. And I picked up Cannery Row and I just read it. And mm-hmm. I'd never read that book. I'd read mm-hmm. Grapes of Wrath. It was required reading in high school, but I'd never read Cannery Row. And are you familiar with that story?
I haven't read it in a long time. I am a little bit familiar. Could you refresh my memory?
It's a short book. It's a novel about these kind of eccentric characters who live in Monterey, California, when the sardines stopped running. It used to be a town that, you know, all the sardines, there's just ocean of sardines that came through there. And in the, mm-hmm. during the Great Depression, probably because of overfishing, but it might have been changes in the ocean currents that had to do with the Dust Bowl and everything. But basically the sardines stopped running and the town, in the midst of the Great Depression, really collapsed. And it's how these people kind of pulled together and in some ways how they didn't. I mean, it's as Steinbeck always does, you know, his brilliant and vivid portrayal of his characters is just so, so extraordinarily powerful. But my book review of that you can find over at BuzzFlash.com. They've got a page of all my book reviews. You might find it interesting because
nice.
I summarized the
yeah.
book there. So, Julie, thank you for your kind words and thank you for calling in today.
Okay, take care.
Much appreciated. Thank you. And John Stein. And now I'm going to go find chapter 14 of Grace of Wrath. I'll bet that Google or somebody else has put it online. It shouldn't be that hard to find. Clifford in Ishpeming, Michigan. Hey, Clifford, what's on your mind today?
Oh, well, I listened to the Republican debate last night. I'm a Democrat, but I like to hear the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, on there last night, one of the things they did is they declared their faith. Now, I know two of them are a Catholic. One is a Mormon, and I don't know what Ron Paul is. I guess I never heard him say anything.
I believe he's Catholic, and I'm pretty sure that Ron Paul's Catholic. But, you know, not that it matters.
Well, you know, I'll tell you what. I have never, you know, you've talked, and in the news they have these born-again evangelists. You know, they're not evangelists. They're born-again hypocrites. Because anybody that can stand up there like they did last night and declare their faith, I don't know what book they read. I'm 74, and I can't say I read it from cover to cover. But I do go to church every Sunday, and I listen to the sermons and so forth. And I don't know, I'd like to really know what book they are reading.
Well, here's the extraordinary bookend for this, Clifford, is that on the one hand, they're proclaiming their faith, and specifically their Christian faith. And I have read the Bible literally cover to cover four times in my life. I'm a very light sleeper, and I discovered years ago that if I read something fairly boring, it put me to sleep. And there's these through the Bible in a year things, and for 4 years I used it to get to sleep. Plus I was fascinated. You know, I wanted to read it. I wanted to be able to say I've read it from Genesis to Revelation, you know, all the way through. And there is only one place in the entire New Testament where the disciples come to Jesus and say, how do we get into heaven? And it's in Matthew 25. You can look it up. And he said, in the last days, I'm going to be sitting there. You know, the Son of Man is going to be sitting on his throne, separating the sheep from the goats. In other words, people go to heaven from the people going to hell. And he said, and he's going to say to the sheep, you know, okay, you get to go into heaven because you fed me when I was hungry. You gave me water when I was thirsty. You gave me clothing when I was naked. You gave, I don't know if he talks about shelter. I think that, you know, clothing would be the modern day equivalent of home when you're homeless. You visited me when I was in prison. And you healed me when I was sick. And the disciples then freak out. Well, let me finish the story. The disciples at that point freak out because they say, you know, we're screwed. None of us are going to go to heaven. We're not going to be with you because, you know, we've never seen you hungry. We've never seen you thirsty. We've never seen you sick. And we've never seen you in prison. How can we possibly? And he said, have done to the least of these among us, you have done to me. And then the other end of that debate last night, just after they were proclaiming their faith, that woman stood up and said, I'm unemployed. I can't afford health insurance. What will you do for me? And all four of them basically said, you're on your own, lady.
Yeah, that's right. And when they're sworn in, they have the gall to say, in God we trust, or, so help me God. I don't know who they're, I don't know if, I hope they are believing that, you know, they will have on that one last day to say, well, gee, God, I know I didn't do a very good job. They might have not have that chance. And I could never, ever, you know, I've been on your program before, and I've served time as a township supervisor, county commissioner, and when it came time, I really think I stood a chance at being a state representative. But there is no way I could honestly do that, because being in the politics, I knew basically all the local politics.
Yeah. Well, that's why, Clifford, we need people. And thank you so much for the call. But that's why we need people like you in politics, because, you know, there's so many people in politics who are there for the wrong reasons. And people should be there because they actually feel a calling to serve others. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program, and I'm still curious. What's the caption to that picture where Jan Brewer is shaking her finger at Barack Obama?
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producer, Jacob Dean, our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our phone screeners, Julie Lulley, our screener researcher, Paul Edney, our writer-researchers Sam Sachs and Andrew Campbell, to Alva Goldbook for our video production, to our webmasters Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager Ron Hartenbaum, everyone at the various companies that syndicate this program, Dow Global on commercial stations, Pacifica Radio on non-commercial stations, Free Speech TV on Dish Network and DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, all the others around the country, to Kurt Gardinier, to Dennis Trunoff, to Don Rojas, all the other great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to Rachel in Santa Fe, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, and all the folks in our chat room. And it's a special thanks to you, Sue. I know it's a great work that you're doing, a tough time for you. To Ellen Ratner and Jay Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you so much. Whew. Larry in Humble, Texas. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind today? Larry, your telephone is not working. I'm sorry. you know, I mean, it's possible it's on our end, but Peggy in Bend, Oregon. Hey, Peggy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Finally.
Yeah, you've been on hold for over an hour. My apologies.
It's okay. I need your sage and compassionate advice on what to do about the latest manifestation of corporate control of the country, aided and abetted by the Supreme Court.
Okay.
On Monday, the one of the decisions of the Supreme Court was to knock down the California attempt to regulate the treatment of downed animals at slaughterhouses by saying that federal law, which supposedly covers that treatment now, trumps state law.
Mm-hmm.
And as you probably know, the corporate control of agribusiness in this country has created monstrosities such as factory farms and
yep.
CAFOs.
Yep.
And it also allows the very brutal transportation of those confined animals
now,
to the slaughterhouse.
You're absolutely right, Peggy, and I agree with you on all points. I must have missed something here. Historically, state laws have trumped federal laws. You know, they go back to the 10th Amendment for that. And so, for example, when California passed tighter clean air emissions standards than the federal law did, the automakers freaked out and sued California. And my recollection is it went up to the Supreme Court back in the 60s or 70s, and the Supreme Court said, you know, the state has the right to have their own standards. And so they had to raise the auto emission standards to the whole country. Pennsylvania used to have the tightest food safety standards. And so, you know, it used to, on cans of food, you'd very often see, say, it would say approved by the Pennsylvania Commissioner of Agriculture, because that meant that was the highest standard in the country, so you could sell it anywhere in the United States. Are you saying that the Supreme Court said that state law no longer trumps federal law when it comes to regulations of our food supply or other things?
That's right. That's
what was
exactly
the name of the case?
I don't know the name of the case, but it Elena Kagan issued that decision.
Really?
And by the way, as far as you know, medical marijuana goes in California.
Right.
You know, California has legalized medical marijuana.
Yeah, and the feds are busting them.
Under certain conditions. But the feds said that's fine and good, but we can come in and knock you down anytime we feel like it because federal law, in this case, trumps California law. And this is what is happening. You know, there have been all kinds state efforts and, you know, efforts by animal rights organizations. In California, for example, there's the a law has passed outlawing foie gras production. It doesn't go into effect until 2014, but is federal law going to knock that one down? Also in Oregon, the Humane Farming Association is running a campaign right now to outlaw battery cages for laying hens. Is federal law going to come in and knock that off?
Well, if the Supreme Court ruled the way that you're saying that they did, then maybe. Although it sounds like, you know, the question is, are we talking about a ceiling or are we talking about a floor? Is this lowest common denominator or highest standard? I'm going to have to go track this Supreme Court decision down and read it. I didn't know that it happened. And I'm usually pretty up on what the Supreme Court is all about. So,
yeah, well, it happened on Monday. You know, the Supreme Court made...
On Monday of this week?
On Monday of this week, right.
Oh, okay.
The first
this
decision
is...
was, you know, about you can't slap an electronic...
right, the GPS was the one that sucked up all the air in the room, yeah.
Right, on your car without a warrant. But then they turned around and said, oh, by the way, you know, downer animals, which are transported under hideous conditions,
right.
You know, they're diseased and they're dying and they're
right.
transported under non-humane conditions. Their legs are broken, and when they open the truck to take them into the to the killing floor of the slaughterhouse. If they can't walk, they put a chain on them and drag them in by their hind legs.
I know.
Or, you know, pick them up with a forklift.
Peggy, I absolutely know. And it's why I was there at the very first meeting of PETA back in the 1970s. Peggy, thank you for the call. I'm like I said, I'm going to have to read up on this. Fortunately, it was this week. It's been an insane week for me, so I plead busy. We will find out, and I'll report back next week. Thanks so much for being with us this week. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, when you participate. It all starts with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.